Three, two, one.
Hello, this is Dr. Phil Fernandez, the Vice President of the International Society of Christian Apologetics. And I'm with Lydia McGrew, Dr. Lydia McGrew, and we're just picking up where we left off. We had some audio difficulties with some of the programs. So the first program, if you want to see that, you can go on to YouTube, the Apologeti on YouTube, and just look for the interview with Lydia McGrew. And so I'm really looking forward to this. How you doing, Lydia?
I'm doing great, Doc.
Good. Well, it was just an honor to get to spend some time with you and to do the interview. I'm really sorry about the audio problem, so we're really hoping everything will go well now, because what you have to say is so needed at this point. And I wanted to talk a little bit about your book, Hidden in Plain View. And so hopefully people can see that on the screen, Hidden in Plain View. And you talk about undesigned coincidences in the New Testament. Can you give us a brief overview of your thesis and how undesigned coincidences can be ammunition for the Christian apologist and show the reliability of the gospel accounts?
I call an undesigned coincidence an incidental interlocking that points to truth. And I only thought of that little summary after I wrote the book, so now I say it in all of my talks. You'll often find a statement in one gospel that intersects in a very casual, subtle way with a statement in another gospel, or you get the same phenomenon between Paul's letters and the book of Acts. So just to give one example of many, I often start with this one because it's short. In the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew is about to tell about the beheading of John the Baptist, and he leads into it in a kind of a flashback way. He starts with Jesus' ministry, and then he says that Herod was saying to his servants, who is this? This must be John the Baptist risen from the dead. That's why so many miracles are being done by him. Now, that little phrase, to his servants, is not found in any of the other Gospels, and in particular, it's not found in Mark. Matthew's wording is very similar to Mark in other respects. Even the flashback motif is similar, but that phrase is unique to Matthew. So one might think, oh, you know, maybe Matthew just made that up to make it more vivid or something, you know, whom was Herod speaking to. But actually, if we go to the Gospel of Luke, we go to a completely different passage, not the lead into the beheading of John the Baptist, though Luke does tell that. Different passage talking about Jesus' ministry in Galilee and how there were these women who contributed money apparently to his ministry, and Luke lists them. One of the ones he lists is Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's household manager. Now, that right away, which is unique to Luke, is an example of how Matthew could have known what Herod was actually saying to his servants. So they interact in this very unusual, roundabout, casual way. We find a lot of these. They support the idea that the gospel authors and the author of Acts are just reporting the facts. They have good access to the facts. They're not engaging in this highly literary project to sculpt their documents and change what happened for literary effect. And what's striking about these coincidences is that they sound like oral history. If you've ever talked about someone, talked to someone who's telling about his memories, maybe of being a soldier in the Gulf War or something, he might bring up some side fact in a very natural way that would fit with something you already knew independently or with what someone else said. That casual accuracy is a mark of truth. And it's a mark that they're not just retailing sources, they're actually having access to the facts.
Yeah, and I think it's really needed at this time. Now, there's I've got something here that it's in print, to Bastion Books, but you could actually go to Global Journal of Classic Theology, this review of Mike Lacona's Why Are There Differences in the Gospel? And so if people don't want to go to Amazon and pick this up, they can actually read it for free. And this is just a handout at conferences and all. And what I like there is that you talk about so many of these, not just Mike Lacona, but so many so-called evangelical New Testament scholars that avoid harmonization, and you say what they're doing. You've coined the term fictionalization. So this harmonization versus fictionalization, could you tell us a little bit about what you mean by that?
Right, and I define the term fictionalization very carefully, and some of the people have taken offense that I use this term. But I'm an analytic philosopher, and analytic philosophers define our terms. This is not meant to insult anybody, but I define fictionalization as an activity that an author engages in when he makes it look realistic in his document, but it's not the way it really happened. Now, this is compatible with a genre, if the Gospels were such a genre, which I don't think they are, and I argue against this, where we expect such fictionalization. So, for example, if you go to a movie that's just sort of based on true events, what do we say to each other? We say, well, it's partially fictional. Nobody gets offended at that. Nobody says, oh, you're insulting people by saying it. We're just like, yeah, you know, they partially made it fictional. I give several examples in my forthcoming book from the movie Chariots of Fire. I like that movie a lot. It's one of my favorite movies. But there are fictional aspects to it. I mean, there's a whole character in there, Lord Lindsay, who didn't even exist. He's a kind of a composite of some other real people, but he wasn't a real person. So that's a fictional aspect to the movie. So but it looks realistic in the movie. You watch the movie, you wouldn't know that he wasn't a real person. You have to go look it up online or something. So this is what they're saying the gospel authors did, that at various places, maybe John makes it look like Jesus cleansed the temple early in his ministry, but that's just his adaptation of what really happened. They think Jesus actually cleansed the temple only once later in his ministry, and John moves it. Not just that he's narrating it out of order, but that he actually moves it and makes it look like it's happening early when it didn't happen early. Now,
so
I don't
purposely doing that, purposely
yes.
not telling the truth, giving a false impression, mm-hmm. and Mike Lacona and others just say, well, that's just a literary device, and okay.
But then they'll say that was okay, because they'll say that the audiences kind of knew, kind of like when I go watch Chariots of Fire, right? I say, well, it's just a movie. So, you know, I know there might be stuff changed, and I need to look it up somewhere else to see if it's right. And they want to portray it as though the audiences knew. They didn't necessarily know which things were changed, but they knew that things might be changed and that they were okay with that, the way we're okay with it in maybe a historical novel or a partially fictionalized movie. Now, that's a very strong proposition. And part of what I do partly in this review, but even more in my forthcoming book, is to refute that idea that this was just a known genre, like we might consider a biopic to be a known genre, where the people kind of go in expecting stuff to be changed. And it's interesting, it would make a huge difference to our knowledge of Jesus' life if the Gospels were really that kind of genre. I mean, imagine if our only access to what happened at a certain time were four biopics. You know, it's like, and all of them might have changed stuff, and we didn't have any more literal historical sources where we could look things up. We'd be guessing.
Yeah.
We'd really be guessing about what really happened. So this is a very strong view, and it's one that we would do well to investigate and not accept lightly.
Now, and I think you mentioned, too, in that review of Mike Lacona's latest work, that supposedly the ancient readers are just – supposed to pick up on this stuff, but in reality, he acknowledges there's no real tag in the text to know when you're going from true historical narrative to a literary device and what you call fictionalization. So there's no
That's right.
clue in the text for somebody to say, like, for instance, with the saints, well, Michael Conas believes the saints didn't rise when Jesus was on the cross. That was just a literary device. Well, you got this whole historical narrative and absolutely no clue whatsoever in the text that, okay, I'm using this literary device now. So it makes me wonder if even ancient readers would understand that.
That's a very interesting point, and I want to make a distinction here. When Mike said that about the saints rising, that's become sort of this paradigm case over the years since his 2010 book. He did at that time try to say there was a tag. And he, at that time, for that one, he tried to say the tag was just all the apocalyptic stuff that the earth quaked and that the rocks were rent and that it just sounded what we might call sort of over the top, and that over the top sound was the tag. That made The Saints Rising a little unusual as compared to what he did then in 2017. In his 2017 book, he's talking about places where he himself does not even claim that there was a tag. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think that Matthew sounds over the top.
Yeah.
I don't think that that counts. I don't think that works. And I've actually written a blog post where I refute that. But it was interesting that he shifted in those years, or maybe he was already thinking this way, but there was a shift from the Saints Rising passage to, say, the Cleansing of the Temple passage, between something where there he tried to say, well, it really sounds apocalyptic if you just read the passage, to things where he's like, yeah, it sounds pretty realistic that Last Supper, for example, he thinks John moved the Last Supper. He literally says in Why Are There Differences in the Gospel, John goes out of his way to make it seem that the Last Supper was not a Passover meal. He actually says that. That's the opposite of putting a tag in the text. That's like trying to smooth it out and make it appear as realistic as possible. So I consider his approach to the Saints Rising passage to be atypical and not typical of his own approach to all of these other passages. And that's why I don't talk a whole lot about the Saints Rising passage in my forthcoming book. I did a blog post instead and I footnoted it. And then I talk more about these passages where he himself admits that they're very realistic. What the people were supposed to pick up on, just like we would in watching a movie, is not the particular passage. Like, you watch it and you go, oh, that looks like that didn't happen, but rather the general, oh, this is a movie anyway, so I know there could be stuff changed here, even though I don't know where.
Yeah.
That's what he thought they knew, and that's not supportable either.
Yeah, I think the scariest thing for me on that is then it's just like, you know, before you preach on Sunday, do you have to refer to these, to the New Testament Scholarship Guild to find out, hey, is this a literal miracle or is this not? And so it ends up, I think the final authority isn't the Bible. It becomes the wild speculation of these New Testament scholars. Now, you recently authored another book entitled The Mirror and the Mask. And I wanted to ask you about that. I noticed that in an advertisement for it, now this is going to come out in November. But I know it's
a pre-order.
The pre-order in November. Peter J. Williams, the principal of Tyndale House, Cambridge, J.P. Moreland, distinguished professor of philosophy at Talbot School of Theology. I'm going to see J.P. at the in another month at a conference we're speaking at. And then John Wark Montgomery, professor emeritus of law and humanities, University of Belfordshire, director of the International Academy of Apologetics. And John Wark Montgomery, man, this guy was actually doing apologetics before I was born, and he was there for the international, the ISCBI, the Chicago Statement, and so this guy, if there's any guy who knows what they were talking about on issues of inerrancy and historical reliability of the New Testament, to get his endorsement is a tremendous thing, but. What is this book, The Mirror and the Mask? What do you mean by mirror? What do you mean by mask? What is the book about? What's your basic thesis?
Right. So this is going to be available for pre-order on November 20th and for order in December. It's called The Mirror or the Mask, Liberating the Gospels from Literary Devices. So in this book, I accomplish two tasks. First, I answer very thoroughly the arguments that not only Dr. Michael Lacona, but others, Craig Evans, to some extent Craig Keener, and Daniel Wallace and others have made for their conclusion that the gospel authors made deliberate factual changes. And I go through and I reply in great detail. I even go back into the Roman literature and refute the case there. So, you know, they claim that we have to believe this because of stuff that they've done research in Plutarch or exercise books of the time. I go and I read all that stuff and I reply to it. So anybody who reads this book will discover that these theories do not hold up to scrutiny and that there's evidence against them. So that's the negative side. But I have a positive side as well. I present a nuanced and a robust model of gospel reliability. I call this the reportage model. And I provide a positive case that the gospels are what I call historical reportage. And I define that very carefully. And I make distinctions. I try to clear up possible confusions about what that reportage view means, but it is a very robust view of gospel reliability that I present there as well. So we've got the negative side and the positive side in this book with a lot of meaty, juicy stuff. There are appendices and everything.
How many pages is that going to be?
Well, last version I saw was about 546 pages, and that includes all the notes because I decided to use footnotes instead of endnotes. I actually did sort of an informal poll of my Facebook followers, and everybody was in favor of footnotes, and that also includes three appendices. And, you know, I encourage readers, don't get bogged down. Don't say, oh, I can't read this all, yeah, so I'm just not going to read any of it. Read the parts that you can read. Yeah. And the appendices are therefore extra reference material. You don't have to read them. But I wanted to do the job thoroughly because, honestly, those who are taking these view, they're going to say something no matter what I do. If I don't address something, they'll say, well, she didn't address this. If I do address everything, they're going to say, oh, the book is too long. Who has time to read it? Don't bother. So I really can't win. Yeah. So I'm presenting what I have there for fair-minded readers who are willing to take a look at the evidence.
Yeah, and I appreciate this so much, too, because it's I'm more of a philosopher of religion. I spend bulk of my time arguing for God's existence. I study apologetic methodologies. I present evidence for Jesus' resurrection. And so I'm only dealing with this, like, this kind of watering down of not only inerrancy, but also biblical reliability, just because it's such a hot topic right now, and it could cause so much damage for the evangelical church. But so I appreciate that there's somebody out there that is putting all this time in, and so, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I accept your scholarship in this field, and you're able to do the research that I don't have the time and probably the IQ to do. And so I'm actually happy that these are like, you know, going to be a 500-page book. And I've got to change the subject a little, but I want to ask your view of the late Dr. Norman Geisler, my mentor, and his ministry. Now, Chris Hahn, you know Chris, and he told me that even though you're not an inerrantist, Dr. Geisler greatly admired your work and respected your scholarship, especially your arguments for New Testament reliability. It's strange to me that the scholars out there that claim to be inerrantists but don't want to talk about New Testament reliability, and they're actually, I think, attacking New Testament reliability, and here you are giving such a robust case for it. But Dr. Geisler respected your ministry greatly, and in fact, Chris Hahn was reading through the manuscript of The Mirror and the Mask to Dr. Geisler. His health was not well, and he didn't get all the way through the book. But I think Chris Hahn he told me that Dr. Geisler greatly respected your scholarship, and probably, much more than likely, he probably would have endorsed the book.
I think so.
And I think it gave him a little bit of peace to know you were out there building this case and doing this work, because he knew his days on this planet were numbered. He's with the Lord now. And so but I was going to ask you about what you think about his ministry, and do you think he was wrong to be alarmed that evangelicals claim to be inerrantists yet embrace what would normally be would normally be considered errors in the biblical text. They don't call them errors.
Right.
They've redefined what the word error is, I guess.
But
I want to know your assessment, Dr. Geisler, in this area.
What I appreciated about him is his clarity and his honesty. You know, one person who knew him personally said to me he was the fairest man I have ever known. And the more I've investigated, the more I've come to think that is a true evaluation. He was a warrior for the faith, and we do need warriors nowadays. I think that notion of being a warrior, which is kind of a military concept, is considered politically incorrect or bad, but it's very necessary. And I think he was right to be concerned and alarmed and partly frustrated. And I think part of what's so frustrating is that you can't get off the ground if your opponents will not allow you to define a thesis and then say, you know, yes or no on it. So if the thesis is, are the Gospels reliable? Well, now they're going to say, we're going to redefine reliability, or are the Gospels inerrant? Well, now they're going to redefine inerrancy, or, you know, do the Gospels, you know, change incidents? I've even had people I've discussed with try to redefine the term incident. So if like every single term is going to be redefined, we can't even get to the point of arguing who's right and wrong, because we can never get a thesis on the table. And I think Dr. Geisler felt that, and he felt that frustration. And he was right to see that people are clinging to the term inerrancy while changing the definition. And that was, to him, undermining his life's work. Yeah. And I think that is understandable that he should be concerned. And I think that fairness in his mind was such that he just wanted the truth to be known.
Yeah.
He wanted to go out there and say, well, this is what these people are saying. And what I've certainly experienced myself is a certain amount of resentment even at reporting what people are saying in clear terms. If I come out there and I define fictionalization and I say, well, they're saying that the authors are fictionalizing, and I like very carefully define it and it clearly lines up with what they're saying. Oh, don't say that. We're saying they're paraphrasing. We're saying they're giving the gist. And I say, no, I'm not going to use those. Those are euphemisms.
Yeah.
Those are confusing people. Let's speak more clearly.
Yeah.
And I say, are you aware of what so-and-so is saying? And just doing that is taken to be offensive. And I think to some extent, that was what Dr. Geisler got blamed for, was informing people.
Yeah. And it's something, I think Dr. Geisler would agree with me too, is that we could respect the scholarship of people. Like for instance, you acknowledge that you're not a full-blown inerrantist, but you also acknowledge that you hold to a very high degree of biblical reliability and New Testament reliability and gospel reliability. So you're clear, you're honest, we know where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
when we pick up your books, or if you're going to give a lecture somewhere, we know what we're going to get.
Right.
Whereas we have so many guys that are, they signed a statement at the Evangelical Theological Society claiming to be inerrantists, and they've just, you know, redefined the word error. But mm-hmm. I like that. I like that, the clarity and the honesty. I mm-hmm. recommend people read Mike Lacona's works. But
absolutely.
Sometimes mm-hmm. I have to say, okay, now just understand this and that, because he's not making it clear. And so I would really like to see more clarity and honesty. Craig Blomberg's, one of his latest books, Can We Still Believe the Bible? He mentions a whole lot of things that, where he says you could be an evangelical and still deny all these things, but then he'll say that he holds to most of them. You know, he's not denying it, you know, and this and that. But he talks about that you could, maybe somebody could deny the Pauline authorship of some of the books, some of his letters, and Moses as the author of the Pentateuch. Now, Blomberg doesn't. He holds to, I think, the Pauline mm-hmm. authorship of all 13 letters and the Mosaic authorship of the Pentateuch. But out of curiosity, I was wondering about where you stand on the Pauline authorship of all 13 mm-hmm. of his letters and Moses and the Pentateuch.
Yes and yes. So I've done a lot more research on the Pauline authorship than on Old Testament issues generally. I think a very conservative position is that, like, the very end of Deuteronomy, the death of Moses mm-hmm. is narrated. You know, that's probably written by someone else. It's like a little postscript. But I think the evidence very strongly supports the Pauline authorship. In my book, Hidden in Plain View, I divide my undesigned coincidences between those that concern the undisputed and those that concern the other Pauline epistles. But I say very explicitly, this is not meant to cast doubt on the Pauline authorship of any of them. I'm just dividing this up for convenience sake if somebody wants to read these chapters rather than that chapter or something like that. So I think the authorship is very strongly established. Hebrews, I'm less sure about, I am inclined to think that Paul actually wrote Hebrews. My own inclination is think that maybe Paul and Luke wrote Hebrews. That would tend to explain the style, which is this very high Greek that could be Luke's Greek putting Paul's thought, because the thought is very Pauline, into
Greek. I believe the thought is Pauline. I kind of favor the Apollos view. At the same time, I think Martin Luther was the first one to suggest it. So that's kind of, I don't have some real early solid evidence for that, but it is interesting. And I'm wondering why there's not that Pauline introduction and that phrase in Hebrews 2 about, it seems that the author is saying, I never met Jesus face to face, but those who did shared the gospel with us, and the Holy Spirit confirmed it with signs and wonders.
Sure.
And
well, and Paul was a little touchy about that question. He never met Jesus when he was on earth.
Yeah.
So it may be that by that time in his ministry, he felt comfortable with talking about that in that way, whereas in the other places, he's like, well, I did see him, as
for
one
me,
born out of time.
He's
just a different way of
he's
looking
always
at it.
Clearly trying to say, hey, look, I got my apostleship from Jesus.
That's a good
and
point.
So it would be, who knows, maybe, but I do think that whoever wrote it, they knew Timothy, and wrote in a higher level of Greek than Paul, and but I think they knew Pauline theology, and it amazes me though that does it amaze you that you could have people who claim to be full blown evangelical inerrantists who might deny the Pauline authorships and might deny the Mosaic authorship of the first five books? Would deny that John wrote his gospel as a group of disciples maybe later on, and Jesus really didn't make the I am sayings. Is that surprising to you?
Well, when you get all of those in there, especially the I am sayings, my eyebrows are like climbing up to my hairline, at that point. The authorship issues you can separate out analytically a little bit, but it's certainly not what one would expect, let's put it that way. I mean, I suppose you could say, hey, it's completely inerrant, even though it was written by a different guy. But it's a little surprising. And I think, as you were saying, Dr. Blomberg's own scholarship is one thing. It tends to be quite conservative. But then what we philosophers like to call meta-level ideas, like what you can believe and still be an evangelical or whatever, on those, I tend to disagree with him more, where I tend to agree with him more on what we philosophers would call the object level, like what, is this historical or not, and what did this – that's not to say I agree with him all the time, but that it's on that object level that he's actually very conservative.
Yeah. And now, and here it gets to the some of the statements of John that recently some evangelicals have argued that when John recorded Jesus saying, I thirst, he or his disciples later on, whichever they choose there, was just paraphrasing the phrase, my God, why have you forsaken me? How do you respond to that?
Well, the first thing I would say is that if somebody calls that a paraphrase, he's abusing the term paraphrase. That is not a paraphrase. And a paraphrase has to bear some recognizable similarity to what it's paraphrasing. The term paraphrase there is one of those euphemisms that confuses people. So let's put it in plain English. The theory is that John invented it, not that he paraphrased. Now, the so-called arguments that Daniel B. Wallace and Michael Lacona have put forward for this, that John invented I thirst, are almost unimaginably weak. That's the other thing I would say. One of the arguments is that everywhere else that Jesus uses the word thirst in John, he's using it in a metaphorical sense. So, for example, Jesus says, if any man thirsts, let him come unto me, and drink. Well, so what? Okay, just because Jesus elsewhere in the Gospel of John uses the term thirst metaphorically, it doesn't follow that he was not literally thirsty. In fact, in one of those places, he asks the woman at the well for a drink. He may not specifically use the word thirst in a literal sense, but he says, please give me a drink. And they're next to a well, and there was real water in the well. So presumably he was thirsty. It was noon. And the dehydration was a well-known effect of crucifixion and all the horrible tortures Jesus had gone through. So there's absolutely – that's a terrible argument that everywhere else he uses the word thirst metaphorically. Then another argument, so-called argument, is this hyper-literary view of John, that John's theme is that of glorification and the cross is a glorification. And therefore, John wouldn't have literally recorded Jesus saying, I thirst. Well – it's a little bit of an uncomfortable fact, but John does appear to be literally recording that Jesus said, I thirst. So how are you going to get around that?
Yeah.
Well, that John could only bring himself to do it if in his private own mind, even though you can't tell from his book, he knows it didn't really happen. Like, John feels better about that. Like, I have this secret metaphorical meaning. And so then it's consistent with my view of glorification because I know Jesus didn't really cry out in thirst. That's very bizarre. That's very bizarre. So there's nothing strong about this. And I want to point out that people may say, oh, that's just an outlier of a theory. Well, I'm not saying a lot of evangelicals hold that one particular theory, but it was something that Dr. Lacona put forward very, you know, he advocated it in his 2017 book. So it is still having an influence nowadays. And if you accept it, or if you even think it plausible as opposed to enormously unlikely, then that's going to affect your view of John and of what kind of a reporter John was.
Yeah, well, a concern I have too here is that, I mean, if you get like Gleason Archer's handbook on Bible difficulties, or Tom Howe and Norman Geisler's The Big Book of Bible Difficulties, I think the title is, they don't even address this because
there's no contradiction.
There's no atheists that are out there saying, look, there's a contradiction. John said, I thirst. The synoptic said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Nobody's even, it's not like we evangelical New Testament scholars are answering an objection. We're inventing
problems,
and we're not solving problems. And so
inventing problems where they don't exist. The only way you can get an apparent contradiction, well, there's two ways. One is by saying that this doesn't fit with John's themes, you know, that I just said. The other is by saying, by counting. You literally, and Dr. Lacona does this, you literally count backwards. How many words on the cross do we find in the synoptics? So it's like, this is the second of the last thing that Jesus says from the cross in John is, I thirst, I believe. It's the second of the last. And the second of the last reported thing that he says in Luke is, my God, why have you forsaken me? So it's like this count backwards thing. Look, I counted backwards, and the second to the last is different in the two Gospels. Now, that's really manufacturing a difficulty out of thin air. I don't even know if Bart Ehrman does that.
Yeah, it's, you know, I was 10 years in law enforcement, and if I did that in my investigations by interviewing two witnesses and assumed that everything that one witness gave me was everything that was said, so that if there's anything extra that another witness is reporting, it's automatically a contradiction, I think I would have lost my job. I mean, that's just not good investigative research. I was wondering if you accept the traditional authorship of the four Gospels, and why or why not?
Well, I do, and it would take, you know, too long to go through all the reasons, but I think the patristic evidence, the external evidence, is very strong. And I also think that Justin Martyr, even though he doesn't name the authors, which is something Bart Ehrman will make much of, but he specifically says the Gospels are the memoirs of the apostles and their followers. And that fits very well, especially since you've got that plural, apostles and their followers. So you've got two Gospels that are the memoirs of two of the apostles, two that are the memoirs of their followers. From an objective historical perspective, if these were not Christian Gospels, nobody would have any doubts about their authorship. Now, Richard Baucom has mounted this very strenuous case, and of course it's not new with him, that John's Gospel was written by a different guy named John, who was also a disciple of Jesus. But he does accept that it's an eyewitness. Yep. He was an eyewitness of Jesus' ministry. So right now, while The Mirror of the Mask is in press, and while we're collecting blurbs and so forth on it, I'm starting to write the next book after that, and that's The Eye of the Beholder, it's going to be called, on the Gospel of John. And I do have a chapter on authorship, and I'm also going to have an appendix on authorship. So in the chapter, I talk about the thesis that this was a close disciple of Jesus. He was an eyewitness of Jesus' ministry. He saw what he testifies. Then in the appendix, I'm going to address specifically, was he the son of Zebedee as opposed to this other John? Yeah. So I do address both. In the body of the book, then, what I'm trying to do is kind of rope in the followers of Baucom, whereas in the appendix, I'm actually answering that. And I don't think those arguments hold up either. I think he was the son of Zebedee.
I think with, was it Papias, I think, where he talks about John the Apostle, and in the next paragraph, John the Elder. And I think he's talking about two different ages, the age of the apostles, and then John outlived that. And then you had these guys that were contemporaries of the apostles that were leaders in the early church called the elders. And I think, to me, I think that's where the confusion is. But I agree with you. I think until I see any evidence better, I think that the early church fathers knew better. And I think Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John that the traditional authorship is on strong ground. Now, I was trained by Gary Habermas at Liberty University, good friend of mine. I love him. Neatest guy on the planet. You know, we've actually had him over here even at your house, Matt.
Yeah.
Matt Coombe is here.
Mm-hmm.
He also studied under Habermas, got his PhD there at Liberty, and even his undergraduate there. And then he also studied under Craig and William Lane Craig and J.P. Moreland and Douglas Guyvid at Talbot for his master's degree. But so Gary Habermas, good friend of mine and all, you know, he and Dr. Geisler were my two favorite professors. But Dr. Habermas taught me the minimal facts case for the resurrection, and Habermas uses it, Lacona uses it, Craig uses it. I like it. And, you know, you take what your opponent gives you, and you say, well, since you hold to this, you should believe that Jesus rose from the dead. However, there's been a big discouragement of are you concerned with the current discouraging of evangelicals to build a case for New Testament reliability? In other words, like when Dr. Habermas, whenever I write a new book, he'd open it up, and if there was a chapter on New Testament reliability, he would be disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say, you know, he said publicly from a stage, you know, when asked about, can we make a case for New Testament reliability at a major apologetics conference with thousands of people in the audience, he made sure he grabbed the mic before others who were on the panel could, and said, we don't have to make a case for New Testament reliability.
Mm-hmm.
Very few New Testament scholars are going to give you New Testament reliability. Mm-hmm. We're better off using a minimal facts case. Now, I know Dr. Mm-hmm. Habermas believes in New Testament reliability. My fear is, though, that we have an entire generation of younger apologists mm-hmm. who don't know how to argue for New Testament reliability anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so
and
I,
they don't think
I was
they
wondering
need
if
it.
You're concerned about that.
Yes, I'm very concerned about that. And I do want to just say that since that time, Dr. Habermas has been here in Kalamazoo. I did not personally hear him on this particular occasion, but my husband did, and came home and said, you will be very happy to hear this. Gary said, we need full reliability.
Good.
So I don't know if his mind has been changed or what, you know, or how to reconcile those two statements there at different times. But I think the minimal facts case, as it is built on the consensus of scholarship, has a pretty major hole in it. And I'm sorry to have to say this, but I think it's an important hole. I have a webinar online. If you go to lydiamcgrew.com, that's kind of my portal, and you go to Webinars for Apologetics Academy, hosted by Jonathan McClatchy. You look for one called Minimal Facts versus Maximal Data. I talk about this there. The major hole is that the consensus of scholarship does not grant you that the disciples had resurrection appearances of the kind that are recorded in the Gospels. People don't know this. I think a lot of people go out there and they present the minimal facts case because they think that the liberal scholars are granting us more than they're really granting us. So they'll say, oh, scholars across the entire spectrum, liberal to conservative, grant that the disciples had resurrection experiences of Jesus. Well, what they don't know is that that could be something extremely vague. These appearance experiences could be just something very brief. It could be an emotion, or it could just be a brief visual experience or something that could be consistent with what we would call seeing a ghost, even. And that's something Dale Allison has made much of, what he calls grief hallucinations. People don't know that. They think that this majority of scholars grants that the disciples literally experienced what seemed like eating with Jesus, talking with Jesus, having conversations with him, and so forth. They do not grant that at all. So if we water down our meaning of appearances, appearance experience, to put it in our premise of the minimal facts case, that shortly after his death, the disciples had experiences of his appearance. And what we mean by that is what will be granted to us by liberal scholarship, then I'm not sure the best explanation is that Jesus rose from the dead. Because if it's something really vague or really brief, then it's like, well, you know, could it have been a really vague, brief hallucination? Or could there be ghosts? Maybe they did see a ghost, you know, or something like this, because we don't really have that very nitty gritty stuff like we have in the Gospels, where he's like asking to eat fish and they're talking with him over 40 days and so forth, especially if you want to argue for the bodily resurrection. And I want to emphasize this. Dale Allison does not believe in the bodily resurrection. Recently, Dr. William Lane Craig did a podcast about Marty Sampson's deconversion, and in it he mentioned Dale Allison's name in passing and said, well, he shouldn't change his view if he's convinced of the resurrection of Jesus on the evidence. And he did not clarify that Allison's view of the resurrection is not of a bodily resurrection. Allison will say, I don't know what bodily resurrection means. And he'll even argue that the evidence underdetermines a bodily resurrection. And Dr. Craig has actually debated him on this subject in a symposium in Philosophia Christi. So if you're going to argue for the bodily resurrection, you're going to need to say that they claimed they had experiences like what we find in the Gospels. So I don't know that Dr. Habermas really intended his minimal case, facts case, to end up going off in the direction that it has, to be used to undermine the necessity for robust gospel reliability, but that's definitely how it has turned out. And I think that he did not make a distinction between epistemology and sociology, that he thought, well, you know, sociologically it feels better if you can use what your opponent gives you, but epistemologically maybe what your opponent is giving you is not going to be enough.
Yeah. And it's one of those deals, because I, you know, to be honest, Dr. Habermas, I think he's acknowledging that he believes the vast majority of New Testament scholars believe that the apostles had experiences in which they believed they had seen the risen Christ. Mm-hmm. And I think Dr. Habermas and Lacona and Craig do a great job using that to build a case for the resurrection. But my main concern is that it's like they act like sometimes it's the only case. And they act like you only use what New Testament critics will give you. Well, you know, there's a lot more. I mean, I don't, if the New Testament critics are not going to give me a whole lot of stuff that the early church fathers give us, if I got to choose between the two, I'm going to side with the early church fathers. They're much closer to the facts. So I don't mind myself. I probably have a little higher view of the minimal facts case, but I don't like when it's the minimal facts case period and you're only allowed to use what your opponent will give you. And then when you deal with the Jesus mythers, they don't give you anything. So if you don't have a 1-2 punch, minimal facts plus historical reliability, I think you're toast. You know, you tell Robert Price or Richard Carrier, the vast majority of New Testament scholars, they'd say, I don't care. They're part of the conspiracy, you know.
Right. Well, and you have to abandon it with others too. In that symposium I was mentioning in Phil Christie, Dr. Habermas and Dr. Craig, they had to abandon minimal facts even in talking to Dale Allison, and he's not even a Jesus mither, just to argue for the bodily resurrection.
Yeah.
They had to go to stuff, and Allison tried to call them on that. He said, I don't know how you're going to make this case that they really had all of these, that the resurrection accounts are really reliable and are what came from them. And it's like, well, we can build that case, but we have to do it, even to argue with him or the deity of Jesus Christ. I find that you know, there's this notion that once somebody accepts the resurrection, the Holy Spirit's just going to sort of zap him. And now he's going to believe, you know, in all these doctrines things. You know, you could believe in the resurrection and be a Socinian.
Yeah.
You know, there were Socinians who believed that Jesus rose from the dead, but that he wasn't God. So
I think Mormons believe in the bodily resurrection.
Yeah, I think they probably do. So I think we're going to need more than that to get doctrine as well. And one place Dr. Craig says something like, I'm going to grant for the sake of the argument, I'm going to grant everything that the skeptic wants to say about contradictions in the Gospels. But I still think I can bring people to be Christians. And I'm like, whoa, you know, what are you going to go tell them?
Yeah.
Now I'm going to take back what I granted to you before. Why should they let you do that?
Yeah.
You know, at a certain point. And if you can make a stronger case, why not make a stronger case from the beginning is my feeling.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And would you mind if I talk a little bit about William Lane Craig and my experience with him on reliability? I think it was around 1995. I was at the meeting of the Evangelical Theological Society, the national meeting in San Francisco, and I overheard a conversation between the late Paul Feinberg, who was working as an editor for Zondervan at the time, and William Lane Craig. And William Lane Craig wanted his work, Apologetics and Introduction, back in print, and Zondervan wanted to put it back in print, but Paul Feinberg told him, you just have to add a chapter on New Testament reliability. And Craig gave all kinds of weird excuses. Oh, I'm not qualified, blah, blah, this and that. But he refused to do it. Well, Zondervan turned him down. So then eventually, apparently Craig went to Crossway Books, but apparently they told him the same thing. So he had to add a chapter on New Testament reliability. Well, he didn't want to write it, so he got his buddy Craig Blomberg. And it's an excellent chapter, by the way, on New Testament reliability. But then in the future edition, in the third edition, he talks about the deletion of the chapter on the historical reliability of the New Testament, a chapter which a former editor had insisted, despite my protestations, he inserted into the second edition. And it was written by Craig Blomberg, and he stated that it perpetuated the misimpression, all too common among evangelicals, that a historical case for Jesus' radical self-understanding and resurrection depends upon showing that the Gospels are genuinely reliable historical documents. The overriding lesson of two centuries of biblical criticism is that such an assumption is false. Even documents which are generally unreliable may contain valuable historical nuggets. And you and I know that Dr. Craig believes in New Testament reliability, but it's almost like he's too embarrassed to even bring it up because the vast majority of New Testament scholars don't believe the New Testament is historically reliable. Mm-hmm. And so he actually apologizes for a chapter that he had his friend write for him in an earlier edition. And it's like, when evangelicals are apologizing for defending historical reliability, even though we believe in it, when we apologize for writing chapters on historical reliability, something's wrong. And so,
I disagree with him too. I mean, I think he's wrong. I think a robust case does depend upon defending reliability. I think we can't do without it. I just disagree with him there. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing that's happened between them, that was 2003 that you just read. That's 2003, third edition of Reasonable Faith, is that the term reliability, instead of, at least he's clear there, you know, at least when there he says, no, I don't think we need to argue for reliability. Even if the Gospels were unreliable, it would, we could still make a case. Later, what's been argued is to change the definition of reliability, though they won't admit that, but they'll say reliable means reliable about the central facts, reliable with respect to the core facts. Now, Bart Ehrman calls them on this every time. I've seen him do it. I saw him do it to Craig Evans in a couple different debates. He said, that's not what reliable means. Reliable doesn't, I mean, a stopped clock, he didn't use this phrase, but a stopped clock is right twice a day. You know, reliable doesn't mean we can get history out of something. I can get history out of a novel. I can get historical facts out of an unreliable historian. So, and I've seen this shift in word usage, even to some extent in Dr. Craig's own usage, that they're reliable with respect to a certain list of facts. That's not what should be meant by reliable. At a minimum, what should be meant by reliable is that if a document or a witness says something, it gives you some reason to think it's true.
That's
kind of a bare minimum. And then we can say highly reliable if they say it gives you a very strong reason to believe it's true or something like that. So I disagree with what he was saying there. And I also want to comment on the shift in the usage of the term reliable that's taken place even since he wrote that.
It amazes me. And here you, I love your honesty because you're not claiming to be an inerrantist. At the same time, you seem to have a much higher view of the historical reliability of the Gospels than many prominent evangelical scholars who do claim to be inerrantists. And that just, it really concerns me. But I do think that evangelical apologists need a robust case for historical reliability. And if we're not going to get it from the Laconas or the Craigs or the Habermases, you know, praise God for Lydia McGrew's ministry. A little bit more off topic, but Robert Gundry's Midrash view of Matthew's gospel, where the wise men was just the retelling of the shepherd's narrative and things of that sort. And that got him kicked out of the Evangelical Theological Society in 1983. And now there's guys that want him back in. But what do you think of his Midrash view of Matthew's gospel, especially when dealing with the birth narrative?
Well, and it's all the way through. I mean,
Yeah.
he's I've read his, I'm not saying I've read every word of his commentary, but I've read good big swatches of his commentary on Matthew. His view is completely without merit. His arguments for it are absolutely dreadful. His entire approach is to put out there a huge number of strained theological interpretations, including every word in Matthew, every tiny verbal difference from Mark. This is called tendens critic. It's and I think of him doing it, tendons critic on steroids. That it, literally, here's an example. In the telling of the feeding of the 5,000, Matthew uses the phrase "when it was evening," I believe it is, or "when evening came," and that phrase is not in Mark. And Gundry literally uses this to argue that Matthew is making a Eucharistic allusion in his telling of the feeding of the 5,000 by inserting this "when it was evening" phrase, like every tiny verbal difference. Then, because he's put out so many bad arguments, he mistakes that for a cumulative case that Matthew invented his facts. And so, like Douglas Moo did a very good job refuting Gundry. They had an exchange in JETS. It's all available for free online. If you look up JETS, Matthew and Midrash was the name of the series. And when Douglas Moo would point these things out, he would say that. That doesn't mean that, you know. Gundry would say, well, I have much more evidence in my commentary. Well, what he had in his commentary were many more assertions.
Yeah.
That it, assertions aren't evidence. They were many more sort of wacky assertions that this was changed from that and this was changed from that, with no evidence to back them up. And I think he genuinely mistook that for evidence. I found in the New Testament world that sometimes the mere fact that a scholar can think up something is taken to make it plausible.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, if I can dream up the idea that that this was Matthew's version of the shepherds, now we have to take it really seriously. Nobody's ever allowed to say, oh, well, no, and just sort of dismiss it. That's a ridiculous idea and move on. I guess that's taken to be rude or something, but pretty much everything in Dr. Gundry's commentary on Matthew is of that level.
Yeah, and it's scary too. You kind of alluded to it, but when young apologists will look and see their heroes will speculate outside the evangelical box and come up with these weird ideas, it's almost like, okay, well then that gives me the freedom to not only hold it to that idea, but to do that same type of speculation myself. It's really really concerning to me.
And I want to say something here about speculation. There is an idea out there that if an author says maybe or perhaps, then it's like a get out of jail free card, or it's like a freebie, like that I can say anything after the word perhaps. And then if someone comes along and criticizes and says, that's crazy theory, it's bizarre. Now, well, I said perhaps. You know, don't criticize me for it. I said perhaps. Now, I disagree with that. I think people should be willing to own the fact that they were treating something as plausible. Nobody considers literally all theories. Nobody does. Nobody sits here. We don't have time. You know, life's too short to literally consider, hey, maybe this was done by aliens or whatever. I mean, if I take the trouble as a scholar to treat a theory as plausible, I need to take responsibility for that fact. I need to say, yeah, I did think that was plausible enough to discuss. And the mere fact that I threw the word perhaps in there, or that I said, oh, I wouldn't rate this, I'm not confident, or I'm not sure. Okay, but I must think it's plausible, or I would not be spending the time to talk about it. And then if somebody criticizes it, I need to not get all up on my high horse and say, how dare you criticize my speculation? I said I wasn't sure. It's like I need to take those criticisms seriously. Seriously. So that's certainly true of many of these things, like I thirst. You know, if you throw the word perhaps in there, I'm sorry, you're still treating it as plausible. So.
And it's interesting too, because when you look at scholars who have moved away from the evangelical position in times past and generations past, it usually starts out with a perhaps, and they test the waters and they see, is anybody branding me a heretic? Are they still going to buy my books? Do I still have my following? Do I still have my teaching position? And then eventually the perhaps, becomes a definitely, later on. So sometimes I wonder, you know, it's even like, too, you mentioned redefining reliability, redefining inerrancy. It seemed to me that the liberal scholars and then the neo-Orthodox scholars, they never really denied anything in a statement of faith. They just redefined key terms. Mm. And so it kind of starts out with just saying the same words, but now they mean something totally different. And until you feel comfortable that you can actually get away with denying it and still keep your position and whatever.
Well, and I don't think it's even always that deliberate. I've really become aware in the last 2 years, since I've 2-3 years that I've been investigating this, of people's capacity for confusing themselves.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, that people don't necessarily sit there and sort of plan and plot all this out.
Yeah.
It's more a matter of what your peers are saying, and you echo what your peers are saying.
Yeah.
You say it back to them, and they say it back to you, and you say, oh, this is great. Now we can be inerrantists.
Yeah.
And people really believe that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's like, I'm the only one, or, well, first it was Dr. Geisler, you know, and then people were really angry at him, but coming along and saying, just change.
Yeah.
What you meant. Well, how do you know people are talking about the same thing? People genuinely believe that they're helping
yeah.
by doing this. They are often very sincere. I almost find that frightening, because what they need is a good dose of analytic philosophy to say, whoa, you know, you're not helping.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and no, you're not still an inerrantist in the same sense. If you know, if I picked
yeah.
out the word, I don't know, the Constitution of the United States, and I meant the use and services agreement for Microsoft, well, I'm not still talking about the same document
yeah.
anymore,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
So they're not going to pick out the same things in the
yeah.
real world anymore.
Well, and we've kind of touched on this a little before, but just get a little more thorough response on about Michael Cohen's views that the saints didn't rise when Christ was crucified, that John changed the date of Jesus' crucifixion, you know, purposely changed it. The soldiers didn't fall when Jesus identified himself, and the gospel authors may have been confused over some of the details in some of their accounts. Do you think any of these are consistent with inerrancy?
I want to separate out the one about the saints rising because of what I said before, where he tried to claim, at least, that there was a tag in the text
yeah.
because it sounded so over the top. I think he made a more how can I put it? He made a terribly weak case that it was over the top and that the people would have recognized it. But I think if the original audience would have recognized it, if he'd been right about that, then you might have been able to get away with that one being consistent with inerrancy.
Yeah.
It's just that it was such a weak case
yeah.
that the audience would have recognized it. And so I think we need to recognize that an author, you know, a scholar can't just take this little post-it note and go, the audience would have recognized it, slap that
yeah.
post-it note down on something, and you've got no case for
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And then, like, get away scot-free, now it's consistent with inerrancy. But at least he tried
yeah.
with that one. With the others, he, I think, would acknowledge that they are narrated realistically within the document. Now, once it's narrated realistically within the document, then it's absolutely not consistent with inerrancy. It's just cut and dried. If you're going to say it didn't happen, and propositionally reading the document, this is what looks like happened, then that's not an inerrancy worth the name. And what's interesting is Mike himself has made the analogy to a movie. That's not just my analogy.
Yeah.
That's in Why Are There Differences in the Gospels. He makes the analogy to a movie based on true events. Now, I want to ask people to think and ask themselves seriously, would you ever call a movie like that inerrant? You know, when I think about Chariots of Fire, would I say it's an inerrant movie? Of course not. You know, of course not. I mean, it's got a character in there that didn't exist. Does that mean I'm mad at the movie makers? No, I love that movie.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, it's like it's not inerrant. I recognized that going in when I watched the movie, so I'm not angry at them. I'm not saying they did something morally wrong, but it's certainly not inerrant.
Yeah.
So if the gospel authors changed the days when Jesus' feet were washed, or John changed the day of Jesus' crucifixion, and as Mike says, goes out of his way to give the impression that the Last Supper was not a Passover meal, and in fact, it was a Passover meal. If that were true, of course, that's not consistent with inerrancy.
And that's where you coined the phrase or the term fictionalization, because
right.
if it's not if that wasn't truly the date, and John purposely
wrote as if.
Yeah. Then that's fiction. That's not historically true. See, with Mike too, it's if he interpreted a few passages differently than I did, and I said no, that's literal history, and he's like, no, that's a metaphor. We wouldn't be butting heads right now. But it's like his subtitle for his work, The Resurrection of Jesus, is a new historiographical approach, and that's what concerns me. Is it's a whole new grid that he's presenting. Mm-hmm. For us to interpret the scriptures, which then allows what you refer to, and I agree with that, fictionalization. I agree with your terming it that, and that's what concerns me. It's a whole new hermeneutic.
Well, I think that's even clearer in Why Are There Differences in the Gospels in 2017. He uses the analogy, I believe this is in his conclusion, of glasses. And he says that he's giving his readers new glasses to put on to view the Gospels. And he says, now, when you get new glasses, you get a new prescription, you sometimes get a headache or it's uncomfortable. And in the same way, if you put on these new glasses that I'm suggesting, this new way of looking at the Gospels, it may cause you some discomfort. But eventually you'll get used to it the way that you get used to new glasses. Now, that makes it pretty clear that this is actually a pretty different way of viewing the Gospels. So yeah, I agree with you. But then at other times, he will prefer to characterize it in this way that seems very minimal, very low key. Well, I'm just saying that there were some details that were not the same or something like that. So it kind of is a rhetorical difference in how he's presenting it at a given moment. But I will say for Why Are There Differences in the Gospels, it's actually quite a clear book.
Yeah, and he's much,
that's,
much clearer.
I appreciated it. I think that book is pretty clear. Yeah. And that's why I chose that book as my foil in The Mirror of the Mask. Mike is by nature a teacher. And I want to say this as a compliment to him. He's actually a good teacher, especially when he speaks, when he gives his lectures.
Yeah.
He's a very good teacher. And so his nature is to be clear.
Yeah.
And he wants to be clear. He wants his audience to understand what he's saying. I don't think it comes naturally to him to obscure what he's saying, but I think he kind of feels a little nervous about how people are going to take his views.
Yeah. And if he would just come clean and say, look, I no longer hold to inerrancy, you know, I would tell people, hey, he's in my book, he's one of the leading New Testament scholars, brilliant guy. I disagree with him on the inerrancy issue. And you know, be aware of his approach. I don't classify the Gospels as Greco-Roman biography. At the same time, you know, I appreciate his scholarship, but it's that when these guys are still claiming to be inerrantist, but they've kind of changed the definition of error. I think I did this in the first part too, but I just want to quote from page 34 of Michael Kona's The Resurrection of Jesus, where he's talking about the Gospels belonging to the genre of Greco-Roman biography, but he says, because bios was a flexible genre, it is often difficult to determine where history ends and legend begins. And, I mean, that would be the last thing on earth I would want to say if I were trying to defend, like, Jesus' resurrection. And but that's what Dr. Geisler used to say, is that what Michael Kona makes such a strong case for the resurrection, but what he gives you with the right hand, he takes from the left hand.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the saints rising, if that can, without a tag in the text, if that could be just a literary device or, you know, a poetic language, then just because you have multiple attestation, now we're supposed to believe that Jesus rose from the dead and appeared to his disciples. Just because you have multiple attestation doesn't mean that it's still difficult. It's no longer difficult to determine where history ends and metaphor begins or whatever. So,
I believe he later took back the word legend. My recollection is that there was a round table about his work, and that he said, and I haven't listened to it lately, but that he said something to the effect that I guess I wouldn't use the word legend anymore. And I seem to recall somebody, if I recall correctly, it was Paul Copan, who said in that round table that he felt a lot better now that Mike had withdrawn the word legend.
Yeah.
But
would he use metaphor?
It's just words,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So,
because even because it's just like, I'm concerned that the resurrection really happened, that it's not a metaphor. Why would I want to classify the gospel genre as a genre where it's hard to tell the difference between metaphors and true history? Now, you've done some research on Greco-Roman biography, and I think you actually argue that it's not really, even that statement, not only accurate of the Gospels, but it's probably not even accurate of Greco-Roman literature.
I would agree. I don't think that it's at all what he thinks it is, even there. I harmonize Plutarch. I mean, so this is why harmonization is not some kind of weird thing. It's something we should be doing with Plutarch and Christopher Pelling, who is a classicist that Mike is very indebted to. Pelling creates problems in Plutarch where there are no problems. He'll say, "Oh, Plutarch changed this incident and when it happened and whether this general was present at the battle." And I go and I read them. That's why I did all this research. And I'm like, there isn't even a contradiction here in the first place. Again and again and again, I would say that that's true, that there's not even a contradiction.
Even when I would write my police reports, I had to be accurate, but we had to do it like a synopsis, like a smaller statement, and then we could do a 10-page statement where I could go fact by fact. And I would often sit there for 10 or 15 minutes trying to figure out how can I state what I want to state and not give the false impression that this event occurred before that event, which occurred before that event. But I couldn't just spell it all out, but I had to write it in such a way that if someone got that, misinterpreted that later on, got a false impression, I could say, well, if you look at my longer statement, that's where I spell it out. But I worded it purposely in a way so that I would not mislead people by making them think something happened before another when it wasn't. And
It's a very important point. Yeah.
now,
That order
again,
of narration is not the same as order of events. Anyway, go ahead.
And then Craig Evans' view of the I am sayings of John's gospel, where he claims that Jesus never really spoke about it. And I know you actually had a debate or a dialogue with him on the Justin
We could call
Brierley
it
show.
debate. We could call it a debate.
Good,
Yeah.
good.
Yeah, I think he's completely wrong. I'm writing this book about John, the Eye of the Beholder, right now, and putting it into book form. And the great thing is that this whole view of John that Dr. Evans promotes is wrong. And that's a good thing because the view that he promotes of John is of someone who's got a very loose relationship with history, extremely loose, and much less historical than the synoptics. And once that kind of special distrust of John is overthrown, and we realize that there's no special reason to distrust John, then we realize that the I am sayings are no more historically suspect than the Beatitudes or anything else you might pick at random out of the synoptic gospels. There's no more reason to doubt I am the way, the truth, and the life than to doubt, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, or whatever. There's just this bias against John, and Evans is then following that. He's bolstering it with poorly supported claims about wisdom literature that Jesus appears to be an allegorical character in John, and it was completely untrue. One of the things I'm talking about in my book that I'm writing, and I did it in my blog series as well, is that in John, we always know where Jesus is. This is a point that Richard Bauckham makes. So he'll say, I am the good shepherd, and he'll go and talk about that for a little while. And it says that he said this when he was walking in Solomon's porch because it was winter. You never hear that about Lady Wisdom in the Old Testament, that she was walking in this highly, specific place. Or the people will suddenly interrupt him and they'll say, "Why do you say you came down from heaven? Isn't he the son of the carpenter? We know his father." And so, needless to say, this never happens to Lady Wisdom. They know that she has this particular history and so forth. So Dr. Evans will give this appearance of great learnedness, and he'll make these frankly outrageous statements about the Gospel of John or other things as well. I saw him in a debate. He stated that there were church fathers who had grave reservations about John and wanted it to be removed from the sort of proto-canon that was developing and the readings that were done in church. There were no church fathers that had grave reservations about John. Not one single church father had a grave reservation about John. So he'll make these statements, but he'll make them with great confidence. And people are like, "Well, I'm not a scholar. What do I know?" And so it's been sort of my rambunctious task to come along and critique that and call him on that.
It's amazing too with his research how much solid evidence there. I mean, he goes into the I believe it was the the Greek word for authentic, saying that Tertullian was saying that he knew of the authentic New Testament books that were still in existence in in Palestine, in the land of Israel, and this is about 220 AD, and he makes a strong case that that word is always used when it means authentic. It doesn't mean really, really good copies. And I was just like amazed at the amount of strong evidence he can provide, and then all of a sudden he just goes off on his wild speculative side, and Jesus never uttered the I am sayings. And it's like God became a man, but he needed a group of John's disciples to poetically, you know, to help God with his poetry, because I guess Jesus couldn't handle it himself. And I personally think that a lot of John's statements, I think John had some prior knowledge of the other Gospels, and I think a lot of Jesus' sayings and some of the things that he did were not selected to be in the other Gospels because of the strong Jewish presence in the early church, that it might offend the Jews. And I think as John's getting a little older and all of a sudden he's looking at these, he's like, well, you know what? There are other things that Jesus taught us as well, other things that he said. And I'm gonna focus on some of that material that the other Gospels didn't deal with. And so, but this idea that this low view of John, and Richard Baucom, you mentioned that book, even though he doesn't believe the Apostle John wrote it, he makes a strong case. This is based on eyewitness information. My only question for him is, John was such a big name apostle, why wouldn't the author of John's Gospel, if he wasn't John, mention John by name in there? You know, it would just kind of strike me as being kind of weird. And but whatever the case,
he has a theory about that, but I don't agree with it. His theory is that the author had a different group of friends and doesn't focus as much on the 12, that he had a different group of friends that he hung out with down in the south, that included like Lazarus and Mary and Martha and Nathaniel, although Nathaniel was from Galilee, but that so that it's just this focus off of the 12. And I don't agree with that. I think 12 are present in John, even if he doesn't use the word the 12 as often.
Well, he's got he's mentioning what the first four brothers selected, and you know, Peter and Andrew, and then you got James and John. John's not mentioned. I mean, just kind of, to me, it really begs the question. Now do you think it makes sense for true evangelicals to join in the search for the historical Jesus? Why or why not?
Well, I think that defending the historicity of the Gospels is searching for the historical Jesus. So if we mean those words, the search for the historical Jesus, in a sort of naive, or I don't want to even call it naive, but an ordinary way, a non-technical way, then go for it. Read the Gospels and try to figure out what they're saying. And that is the search for the historical Jesus, because there's so much evidence that they are memoirs of Jesus. However, I don't agree with the search for the historical Jesus in the technical sense, because that involves assuming that the Gospels are suspect and then using what are called the criteria of authenticity to go, and I call it the pericope by pericope approach. A pericope is a segment by segment approach. So we go to this segment and we say, hey, does this meet enough of the criteria of authenticity to think that it really happened? If yes, yes, you know, if no, no, if maybe, maybe. Then we go to the next segment. We just like, now we start all over again. Let's forget what we just did there. You know, now this is like we have amnesia every time. Then no matter how many times we confirm the Gospels, we're supposed to wipe all that out and start from square one with each new segment and say, hey, is this segment authentic? Is that segment authentic? Now, that's not good epistemology. As an epistemologist, I'm going to say that we need to use induction. If you're confirming that things, this and this and this is probably true and probably authentic, comes from a witness, comes from a reliable source, then even if you can't fulfill some special criterion of authenticity for some other incident over here, you should treat it as part of the same document. So I think we should look at the document as a whole and test their reliability. And so that's why I question the search for the historical Jesus in that technical sense, not because I'm an evangelical and it would be heretical, but because I think it's a poor way to do history.
Yeah. So it's kind of like if it's if an evangelical is looking into it just to get a better understanding of what the Gospels are talking about and its portrait of Jesus, that's fine. But if we're acting like the liberal and neo-Orthodox New Testament critics who believe the Jesus of the Bible is not the true Jesus of the history, let's go find them. It seems like an oxymoron for evangelical scholars to engage in it at that level. And yet it's like a badge of courage, it seems to me, that they...
Well, and it's question begging as well, because we don't know that the Jesus of the Gospels is not the Jesus of history.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't know that going in, and don't beg the question against that.
Yeah.
You have to give that a run for its money in order to be a good historian and a good scholar.
And of course, if a skeptical scholar denies the possibility of miracles, then automatically he's going to start with the Jesus of the Gospels is not the true Jesus of history. And could Jesus's view of the Old Testament inerrancy have been mistaken?
Now, that's an excellent question. And this is when you start making things a little hot for me, which is fine. That's good. You can do that. And I don't think Jesus was mistaken about anything. Okay. Jesus was God. So I never say, oh, Jesus just made a mistake. The verse that is often cited here is Matthew 5:18, not one jot nor one tittle of the law shall pass away until all is fulfilled. Now, I myself do not interpret that as articulating a Chicago statement kind of view of inerrancy of the Old Testament. I think he's articulating there a high authority of the Old Testament. I think he shows that when he cites, for example, Genesis, in the beginning it was not so. He made them male and female for his defense of marriage, his view of marriage. So I definitely think Jesus had an extremely high view of the Old Testament. And I strongly disagree with those who would say we need to unhitch from the Old Testament, or the Old Testament has no applicability today because it's in the Old Covenant. I've even seen people say that none of the Ten Commandments apply to us unless they're – the only reason they apply is because they happen to be repeated in the New Testament. And I reject all of that. So I would definitely encourage people not to strain at a Lydia McGrew and swallow an Andy Stanley, as it were, like straining at a gnat and swallowing a camel.
Yeah. Okay, and then now – You do believe the Bible is the Word of God, and and so if it is, could God make errors? Like Dr. Geisler used to argue, the Bible is the Word of God. God cannot lie, therefore the Bible is without errors.
So there's your sort of deductive case, those are very legitimate questions. And I want to be frank and admit I do not have a highly worked out theory of inspiration.
Okay.
I don't claim to have one. I don't know how inspiration works. I'm just going to say that right up front. I'm sure none of us accept the strict dictation view. I don't want to make a straw man or a false dichotomy. I understand that there are more nuanced views that are still compatible with inerrancy, but it seems to me at least possible that the Bible is the Word of God, but that the Holy Spirit had reason to permit the human authors to make some errors. And I realize that's not the standard inerrantist view, but in the Gospels, I would say that if that's the case, it's because they enhance the evidence for the independence of the works, and they enhance their what I would call texture as witness testimony, because witness testimony certainly does, and I know that inerrantists can acknowledge this, contain apparent discrepancies at times, and that those apparent discrepancies show that these are independent. And then I would just take that one step farther and say that in some cases, it seems to me the best explanation in a few of these cases is that they probably really are some minor discrepancies.
Yeah, and obviously, I'm a full-blown inerrantist, and I don't hold to the dictation theory. I think God guided human authors using their vocabulary, their personality, but guided them to record his word without error. And and I would base it on more than just one passage in Matthew, where Jesus would say, "Thy word is truth," where Jesus said the scriptures cannot be broken, where he bases a whole case for the resurrection and life after death on the tense of the verb in Matthew 22. And But what I'm trying to get at is that I'm trying to find out from you if, like, right now we're being called all kinds of names, inerrantists, and by other guys who claim to be inerrantists. Sometimes they call us Geislerites, when I can list 15 areas where I disagreed with Dr. Geisler on. Sometimes they call us, was it bibliolatrist, that we worship the Bible and things of that sort. But what I'm, well, let me put it to you this way. Both presuppositionists, I'm not a presuppositionist myself, but both presuppositionalists and classical apologists who are true inerrantists presuppose biblical inerrancy before, you know, looking into the scriptures and exegeting the scriptures for a sermon on Sunday. And now with the classical apologists, we usually start out with arguing for truth, man's ability to know truth, the existence of God, the possibility of miracles, the reliability of the New Testament. Then we show that Jesus claimed to be God and proved he's God by performing public miracles, rising from the dead, and fulfilling Old Testament prophecies. And then, well, what did Jesus, the God-man, say? Well, he seemed to teach that the Old Testament was God's word without error, and seemed to promise that, you know, heaven and earth would pass away, but his words would never pass away. The Holy Spirit would guide the apostles into all the truth. And so we build our case for inerrancy on the person of Christ, and then we go into our work. But what I'm getting at is, do you think it's impossible to be a full-blown inerrantist like David Farnell, and to be does that disqualify him from being a true New Testament scholar?
I don't think that full-blown inerrancy disqualifies you from being a true New Testament scholar, but I think there's something that you can do that helps to make clear why. And that would be to say something like this. When I harmonize because I'm an inerrantist, but I would harmonize even if I weren't an inerrantist.
Yeah.
That is to say, to say that may be part of my personal motivation, but it's not necessary for a motivation, you know, because otherwise, harmonization gets treated as a religious activity.
Yeah.
And I think it's extremely important to understand that harmonization is a historical activity. Because as long as harmonization is being put forward as a religious activity, well, we do this because of our view of inspiration, then people dismiss it. And it creates, I think, a kind of cognitive dissonance in people who go to perhaps a more liberal seminary to get their degree. They go and they get a degree in New Testament studies or something, and they're under this relentless pressure. You know, harmonization is stupid. I mean, Dr. Craig, William Lane Craig, tells a story about Wolfhart Pannenberg giving him a hard time for harmonizing the gospel narratives of the resurrections. You know, Herr Craig, I think that you still are somewhat of a fundamentalist or something. You know, he's making fun of him. So and I talk about this in my conclusion to The Mirror of the Mask. I think that that conclusion is really important. When people get it, go flip to the end and read the conclusion, because I think I really get into this mindset. They come to feel that there's a tension between their integrity as a scholar and they're engaging in harmonization, because they say, well, I'm just doing that because I'm an inerrantist, because I presuppose the inerrancy of the scriptures. So now what? Okay. Yeah. Once we understand that the harmonization is independently defensible, and we say that loud and clear, regardless of whether you're an inerrantist, then you don't have to feel that tension anymore, because you can say, I may be partly motivated by the fact that I'm an inerrantist, but that's not the only good reason for doing that. So I would just encourage people to really say that. And I think that's part of what's made it hard for Dr. Lacuna and some of his followers to understand me.
Yeah.
There was one blog post that Dr. Lacuna wrote where he referred to me, and he said that he thought that the reason I objected to the theory that John made up the Doubting Thomas sequence. He brought up this theory. This was one where he said, perhaps, like we were talking about, you know, perhaps John made up the Doubting Thomas sequence. But then he said, Lydia's very upset about this. This appears to be because of her view of inspiration. He didn't know me at all. He
Yeah,
didn't know where
yeah,
I was coming from at all. It wasn't because of my view of inspiration. It was because of my view of John. Because I don't think John is that kind of author. I don't think that that's what, where the evidence leads us. I think that it's taking a very low view of John to say very casually, hey, perhaps he made up the whole doubting Thomas sequence, even if you throw perhaps in there. So that's what I would encourage. I would encourage scholars like yourself and Dr. Farnell and others to pause from time to time and say, and by the way, even if I weren't an inerrantist, I would still harmonize.
That's good. Good piece of advice. Out of curiosity, about how many passages or details in the Gospels would you do you still have? I'm not even going to ask you to, we don't have enough time to spell them out, elaborate, but approximately about how many?
I don't know. And sometimes it depends on whether you consider something an error or a contradiction or not. So an example here is that Luke says they returned to Nazareth when they had completed the rites of her purification in the infancy narrative. Well, he doesn't say they returned immediately to Nazareth, you know? So even if we say Luke didn't know about the flight to Egypt, which maybe he didn't, is that an error? Well, he doesn't say immediately, so nothing strictly erroneous makes it into what he says, right?
Yeah.
So do we call it an error because of what he may have thought, you know? So it depends on whether you count those, but I don't know. Fewer than 10?
Yeah, see,
you know, I don't know.
I was just going to say there's probably 5 to 10 passages,
you know,
where I have been unsuccessful at harmonizing, and so I just want to point out, I'm coming at it more from a theological perspective, from my classical apologetic methodology, so that when I start reading the text, I already presuppose inerrancy because of my classical case for Jesus' deity. And so for me, there's probably 5 to 10 passages that both of us, and they might even be the same ones for all I know, but I think your study is more in depth than mine. So, but I wouldn't be surprised if we have the same number of passages where we have a question mark. But for me, my default position is inerrancy. Okay, I'll never figure this out. I can't figure out how to harmonize it. I'll ask Jesus when I get to heaven. But I know based on my previous beliefs and my theological stance, which I think I can make a case for, that the Bible's inerrant. So on those, I would just kind of, for myself, I said, well, I'm an inerrantist who can't harmonize everything. I'm not omniscient. And if Phil France can't figure it out, that doesn't mean that there's no way to harmonize it. Whereas you would be a lot more open to the possibility that, okay, maybe there was an error in a detail there. And so
exactly.
I don't think we're real far. And in fact, the guys at ISCA and Defending Inerrancy, we've had this discussion about you, about man, if we could just give her a case for the passages that she's in question upon, she could be a full-blown inerrantist. But so it's kind of like I deductively come at it after making my apologetic case, whereas you're inductively building your case. And
I agree with that, and I think that should be your fallback as an inerrantist. What I don't think, it was interesting, Dr. Lakota did a series of interviews with Tim Stratton on the Free Thinking podcast. This was in May of 2018, I believe, so about a year and a half ago. And they were talking about me, and it was interesting. They didn't want to name me. And they kept saying, my critics. I don't know. I sort of got, like, multiplied. Like, there were three of me or something. But,
well,
you know, my
scary
critics,
individual there. So.
Yeah, so I turned into a plural there. But anyway, and Tim Stratton said at a certain point, I think it was he, one of the hosts, said, well, if they, you know, don't agree with your approach, Dr. Lakona, why not just have your approach as a fallback? That if they can't harmonize something, your approach would be a fallback. And I was astonished when I listened to that. I thought, I would never have that be my fallback.
Yeah.
That one of the gospel authors made something up or changed something deliberately. Why not have as a fallback what you, Phil, just said, which is that, well, I just don't know. I'm just going to, you know, remain in a state of admitted ignorance about that or something.
Yeah.
Or in my own case, my fallback would be, you know, maybe somebody made a good faith error. But a good faith error is a lot less destructive of our confidence in the witness than making something up. And if I did this in part one, forgive me, I haven't listened all the way through part one recently, but I like to use a courtroom metaphor, which you'll appreciate as a former law enforcement officer. If you had a witness on the stand and you said to him, what day did this take place? And he said, I think it was Saturday. And then cross-examining counsel comes in there and forces him to admit it was Wednesday. Okay, now our scenarios diverge. In the first scenario, the witness says, I'm sorry, you're right. I made a mistake. We went to the same place for dinner on Saturday and Wednesday, and I guess you're right, it really was Wednesday, not Saturday. That would have one effect upon your confidence in him. You'd be like, okay, he's not infallible, right? You know, okay, he could make a mistake, but he's trying to tell the truth. But now suppose instead that he said, oh yeah, I knew it was Wednesday all along. When I said it was Saturday, that was a literary device. Now, yeah. We're going to have a very different view of this guy. Yeah. We're not going to trust this guy anymore. Because what else is he doing that's a literary device? So I use a cancer metaphor. I say that literary device that he could just change it on purpose, that metastasizes. It metastasizes far faster than the statement, oh, you know, okay, I guess I made a small error, I'm sorry, okay, because that's more limited in its effects. And the reason why it's more limited is because we have a kind of a good idea about how often honest, informed, truthful witnesses make those kinds of mistakes, and it's pretty small. Whereas once we're off into the realm of just making stuff up, that could be much larger if he's doing it deliberately. So this is why I think we need to not be thinking of everything as in the same level at any kind of fallback. Let's have a fallback of a literary device. That's not a good fallback of to have fictionalizing literary device as your fallback.
So you'd say that the Phil Fernandez I don't know fallback would be a lot better for an narrativist than the Mike Lacona literary device fictionalization fallback. So.
Absolutely.
Lydia, I want to thank you for your time. We got one question left. You've been gracious to you going through this twice. Our audio problems.
Oh, my gosh.
Matthew J. Coom, I want to thank you, Professor Coom, for all the help that you've given on this technology part and all. Here's my final question. If a church or school, this is kind of a sensitive issue, but if a church or school requires a belief in inerrancy, an employee of that church or school starts to water down inerrancy by redefining what an error is, does that school or church have the right to terminate their employment? And this is because of Mike Lacona. He was working for the Southern Baptist, their board. He was their main apologetics guy. And Dr. Norman Geisler informed Albert Mohler, at that time, the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, that Lacona was doing this. And, you know, Mike, lost a really good job. And so there's a lot of feelings about that and all. But it just seems to me, if I started watering down inerrancy, guys behind at my church, they would fire me. They would remove me from the pulpit. And at the school I teach at, I'd get booted out of. And at the colleges that I do some adjunct teaching at, I would get fired. And it just seems to come with the turf. But I was wondering your opinion on that.
Well, it depends on the contract, of course, but if the contract requires you to sign this statement of faith, especially if you have to sign it every year, a lot of times the reason that faith-based schools will have their employees sign something every year is in case their view has changed.
Yeah.
So the obvious intention of having you re-sign it is to find out, you know, sorry, if your belief has changed, we don't want our church or our school changing with you. And so there's a clear idea there that you're supposed to leave if your views change and become incompatible with the intention of the authors of the statement. And I would make an analogy to, say, infant baptism. So suppose that you work for a Presbyterian organization and their statement of faith includes infant baptism. And then, you know, I don't believe in infant baptism myself. I believe in believer's baptism. So suppose you read the Bible and you come to believe in believer's baptism. And then, you know, that time of year comes around again, you're supposed to sign the statement of faith and it contains, you know, infant baptism is a covenant or whatever, you know, you shouldn't sign it.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't just say, well, I still believe in infant baptism and like change the meaning of it or something like that and say, now I have a grievance if you fire me if I'm out there teaching believers baptism. Now, there can be difficult cases where it's the school itself that changes, or the church itself. Maybe they took a more lax approach to the enforcement. Maybe when someone came in, he was told, oh, just sign, don't worry about it, or something, you know, by some sort of a lax administration. And then later, you have some kind of a crackdown or someone who says, this isn't good, we want to change the way we enforce this. That's hard on the people who are already there. And so whether there should be some kind of grandfathering that goes in there, I'm not going to get into every possible scenario. But where a school has been or an organization has been consistent all the way along, and it's the employee whose views have changed, then, you know, I think the very act of signing the statement shows that you acknowledge you are not entitled to continued employment.
Well, thank you very much, Lydia McGrew. Now, your book that's coming out, The Mirror and the Mask, and that'll be available for pre-sales November 20th.
Mm-hmm.
And it's endorsed by people like J.P. Moreland, John Warwick Montgomery, Peter Williams. And I can't wait to get a copy and start digging into it. But I thank you so much for your scholarship. And I thank you for, you know, speaking the truth in love. I thank you for your clarity and your honesty. So we know exactly, you know, we know where we agree, where we disagree. But the guys at Defending Inerrancy and the International Society of Christian Apologetics hold your scholarship in a very high regard. And I really, really think that Dr. Norman Geisler, had he lived long enough, would have endorsed your book. Chris Hahn was reading it to him. And I even like the fact, I think you should feel very, very, very proud knowing that that was probably one of the last things being read besides the scriptures to Dr. Geisler, as he was pretty much on his deathbed.
I think he wanted to endorse it. And I want to encourage your listeners, please follow me on Facebook. So you can go to Facebook and look me up. The picture of me, you'll know it's me because I'm there and I'm in a red dress. And so just look up Lydia McGrew on Facebook, and I have public content. You do not have to be my Facebook friend in order to follow my public content. You do have to have a Facebook account to follow that. But you can just click follow, and then you'll get announcements when this is available for pre-order, The Mirror or the Mask. You'll get little things right now because I'm writing the John book. I'll often put little tidbits about John on my public content and other things, cultural issues and so forth, that I'll post about. So please do follow me on there in order to keep up with what's going on. And thank you, Phil, and thank you, Matt. And I look forward to sharing this all over the place.
All right. Well, God bless you very much. If you want more information on me, you can go to philfernandez.org. Philfernandez.org. Got over 1,700 sermons, lectures, and debates that I've done, the audio and a lot of video. And visit the Defending Inerrancy website, and hopefully people will think about becoming members of the International Society of Christian Apologetics. Lydia McGrew, give your husband – I never met your husband – Tim, yet love his stuff.
Smart dude.
Yeah, give him a big hug for me and for Matt. And God bless you. Continue to fight the good fight of faith. God bless you, sister.
Thank you. You too. Bye.